Hello. Thanks so much for coming to our talk, Artificial Life as Art. I'm a partner and director of product development at Sathara Systems, and my name is Sadia Akasha.
And I'm Nathan Lockenmeyer, and I'm the other half of Sathara Systems. I'm the director of technology.
Sathara Systems is a design and technology studio that creates interactive works in order to challenge audiences to think critically about the future. We take ideas about complex systems and break them down into easy-to-digest pieces. We provide opportunities to reflect on the things that are important to us, and we create experiences that give audiences a sense of wonder and inspire them to do more.
And while we're experts in technology and design, our work actually takes us across a pretty diverse variety of domains. So we create interactive installations that focus on topics like cancer research, like climate change, linguistics. And what we bring to each project is a way of thinking about the world, not necessarily expertise in each of the topics that you see at face value. We always try to highlight opportunities to show people how systems interact with each other, to see where different topics might intersect, and to provide opportunities for people to self-reflect. So in this talk, we want to share with you an idea that we've been thinking a lot about over the past 2 years and how we decided to approach it in getting the public to think about it. And that topic is artificial intelligence. But before we talk about artificial intelligence, we need to talk a little bit about human intelligence. So like all talks at South By should start with, we're going to start with a verse from the Bible. Then God said, "Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So since before biblical times, the majority of humanity has perceived the world through this image. It seems pretty natural to almost all of us to think that there's a hierarchy of complexity in the natural world, and for us to assume that that hierarchy implies a lot of value on different kinds of life. Most of us don't think twice about thinking that plants are kind of at the bottom of the tree of life. Insects have a little bit more value than that. Birds have a little bit more value than that, and so on and so forth. And we think of humans as being on the top of this pyramid and having the most value and the most privilege in the natural world. And what this says about us is that we've conceptualized human intelligence as also being different from the kinds of intelligence that all of other life exhibits, be it animal, plant, or machine. We take for granted that this is a universal concept, but it's only actually existed for a pretty short part of humanity.
There are cultures that who position what we think of as human as part of the world, that is also including plants and animals, rather than as something unique and separate. In ancient Mesopotamia, the prevailing thought wasn't that man ruled over nature, it was that we were simply a part of nature. Many indigenous cultures have no tradition of land ownership, and without owning land, you can't really own the plants and animals upon it. In Japan, Shinto practitioners believe that nature doesn't belong to us. Instead, we belong to nature. And spirits, or souls, live in everything, including rocks, tools, even empty spaces. It's this distinction of human intelligence as separate and unique from all other forms of intelligence that gives rise to many of our difficulties with thinking about what intelligence really is. There are two main issues with this anthropocentrism. The first is that having a hierarchy implies, as Nathan said, that something has to be at the top. And in that way of thinking about the world, that being has ability to own and control all other beings. This means that we, in turn, have a fear of being removed from that position, from the top, of somehow being controlled by those that we oppress.
And this is a trope that's existed for hundreds of years in humanity's interactions with technology. We all know the story of Frankenstein and the story about a man playing with the powers of creation, except the story is actually about much more than that. The story was written in 1818, during the peak of the Industrial Revolution, when much of the Western world was seeing the rise of factories, of interchangeable parts, and people saw the power of technology and how rapidly it was changing humanity for the very first time. And during this era of discovery and industrialization, people saw that technology had the potential to replace people. And that was probably one of the first times that people really felt and saw just how immediately that the things that they were doing could be replicated by something else, or so they felt. The core theme of Frankenstein isn't actually about playing with the powers of creation. It's about what happens when technology outpaces responsibility. It was about what happens when technology advances and we don't think about how it's affecting our culture and our social structures. In the story, Victor Frankenstein loses control of his experiment in his attempts to create new life, and we all pretty much know how that goes. But it's telling that our worst fears that are communicated in this story are about how we lost control of our technology. It's not about the morality of the technology. It's not about should we have considered more if this is something we should integrate. It's about that we lost control and we feared that we would become the oppressed instead of the oppressors. And this is a popular theme in media over the past 200 years. In the 1920s, Metropolis is another story about machines interacting with people and about how machines are used by the wealthy to sow disinformation and discord amongst the working class. In the golden age of sci-fi in the 1930s and 40s, again, we saw technology advancing during World War II. And as thinkers thought about how technology might change the world that we live in, they also thought about how difficult it might be to control the unintended side effects of this technology. But in each instance, the lens that we looked at this from was as technology, as replacing humans, as being anthropomorphic, and really about what happens when we lose control of that technology. We really see technology in all of these stories as the slaves waiting to become the masters. And all those examples I just gave you were before artificial intelligence even existed. The advent of artificial intelligence as a research field only exaggerated this trend that had already been existing for 150 years in the way that we see technology. Modern stories emphasize the potential humanity of machines in Ex Machina and Battlestar Galactica, Westworld, and Star Trek. But even in all of these stories, we see machines as threatening to escape our control, and we see them as potential oppressors in wait. So where does this really come from? Artificial intelligence in particular has always been a field about replicating human intelligence, not just intelligence in general. In the earliest work in the 1940s and 50s, artificial intelligence was about recreating the human brain and making electronic brains. As most of us know about the Turing test, created in the 1950s, we set the bar of intelligence at the very beginning as, can computers fool us into thinking that they're human? We didn't think about other kinds of intelligence that might be worth replicating or other things that might be useful yardsticks. We've always just decided that being human is the natural yardstick for measuring intelligence. So by creating these comparisons, we've really confused what artificial intelligence should be able to do, and we've unintentionally limited ourselves into a fairly narrow idea of how we should be interacting with it. We've created this false narrative that inevitably robots are going to automate our jobs, they're going to replace our friends, that they're going to replace humanity, and we hold a lot of fear about what'll happen once they're successful about it. And even though the humanoid robots that I've shown you feel a little cliche now, they feel like something from the 80s and 90s, we still continue to use human metrics of intelligence. Some of the greatest milestones in history have been when machines surpassed humans in what we think of as human tasks, like chess, Jeopardy, Go. And now we're asking computers to automate the creation of visual art and music, we're asking them to drive cars, we're asking them to emulate customer service agents, and we're asking them to replace workers in factories. When we explicitly measure the success of our machines by if they can beat humans at tasks head to head, is it any surprise that we're worried about being replaced?
By creating these comparisons to humans, we confuse what artificial intelligence should and should not be able to do, unintentionally limiting how we could design and use them as tools. Instead, we create this false narrative that inevitably robots are going to automate human jobs and artificial intelligence will replace your wife. This comparison to humans limits our ability to think about artificial intelligence in novel ways. That isn't to say that no one is thinking about it in any other ways. There are well-known roboticist thinkers, such as Rodney Brooks and Mark Raybert, the founders of iRobot and Boston Dynamics, respectively, having long advocated for non-anthropocentric ways to think about robots. And they've founded extremely successful robotics companies based off of those approaches. Rodney Brooks, the founder of iRobot, is infamous in robotics circles for his command that it is unfair to claim that an elephant has no intelligence worth studying just because it does not play chess. Animals can sense the world around them, make their own decisions, and act upon their environment to complete goals. And on top of it all, they often do it in ways that are very, very different from how humans perceive the world and approach problem solving. Humans have actually used animals to amplify their labor by plowing fields with oxen or by training camels to carry them through, difficult environments like deserts and transport goods. We've even trained falcons to help us hunt.
And if you think that those are examples from before technology, even recently, we use animals as a form of technology all the time. Cats have been used not just as companions, but as a pretty effective mechanism of disease control and protecting food stores from pests. Pigeons were used even in World War II to carry messages across Europe, and were even used by the Nazi government as spies by attaching cameras to them as they flew back and forth over the regions. And even in the 1970s, the Department of Energy used ferrets to clean the particle accelerators at Fermilab, because it turns out it's a lot easier to teach a ferret to go through holes than it is to take apart a $500 million particle accelerator. And you'll notice that all these examples that I'm showing you have something in common, and that's humans. Even as we found animals have different kinds of intelligence and different ways of interacting with the world that complement our own, in none of these cases has the adoption of this new form of technology meant that human jobs went away or that humans were being replaced. Just because we have oxen to plow our fields doesn't mean that farmers don't exist anymore. So what does this tell us about our future with machines? The future is the Centaur. The Centaur is a concept in human-computer interaction that arose after Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov at chess. Human-computer interaction scientists researched what really happened and what made computers better than humans at playing this game. And what they found through their studies was that, yes, machines beat human players at chess almost all the time. But what they found that was interesting was that human players consulting with a computer could beat machines almost entirely. So they found that humans have a different kind of intelligence. We can perceive open worlds, we can think creatively, we can handle unexpected situations in ways that machines can't. Machines can compute extremely fast, they can calculate possibilities, they can think 100 or 1,000 moves ahead. But those are two completely complementary ways of looking at the world. And this should be our model looking forward. Rather than thinking about having self-driving cars, let's stick with computers matching drivers and people that want rides, and let's stick with computers being good at navigation. Driving's complicated, and there's a lot of unexpected circumstances that could happen. We're finding that AIs can successfully flag network security threats for evaluation by professional analysts who can identify what's really going on. And there's some filmmakers that are experimenting with machines, framing shots and automatically taking videography, which lets professional filmmakers think more about the storytelling and the creative aspects. And these are all different ways that AIs can collaborate with people to take off some of the repetitive, laborious tasks and allow people to do what we do best. So just like we've lived with animals for millennia, how can we coexist with machines in a way that amplifies our strengths? How can we interact with them in ways that makes up for our weaknesses? How can we think of them as assistants and collaborators instead of replacements? To put it another way, how can we think about integration and augmentation over deployment and replacement?
All right, so with that, let us tell you a little bit about this project that we worked on, about decentering human intelligence as conceived by the artist Annika Yee. In 2019, the artist Annika Yee reached out to us to partner with her on a project that uses technology and biology to question human assumptions about intelligence. Here's some quotes from Annika, so just so you can get an idea of what she was thinking about while you enjoy some of her past works. "I've really been trying to interrogate how the human being is shaped and how the human is evolving in the context of technology." "One of the studio's primary interrogations in the last few years has to do with the human and what constitutes the self. The self is composed of a multitude of entities. So the notion of an individual starts to collapse when you consider that a human is actually a multi-species project. We can therefore state that an autonomous, sovereign self is not possible. Instead, we are vessels of interdependence." Annika was selected as a recipient of the Hyundai Commission Award for the year 2020. Hyundai Commission is an annual series of site-specific works that are created to be shown at the Turbine Hall at the Tate Museum. This is a museum right at the River Thames in London. And they select international artists as part of this long-term relationship and partnership between the Tate and Hyundai Motor Companies. Some of the past artists that have shown and have received the Hyundai Commission Award are Olafur Eliasson, whose name I might be pronouncing incorrectly. But the Tate Modern's Turbine Hall is basically an opportunity for artists to create conceptual and technically ambitious projects in an old converted power station. So the space is huge. You can get a little bit of a sense of the scale by just looking at it. In 2003, Olafur Eliasson made a statement about global warming and climate change by creating a weather system inside the turbine hall with mist, clouds, and an intensely orange sun. Most recently, in 2019, Kara Walker created Fons Americanus, a monument that explores a history of violence against Black people in Africa and its diaspora, rather than celebrating the history of colonialism from a European power's perspective. As you can see, the projects are big not just in their physical presence, but also in the ideas that they attempt to explore. So for this commission, this Hyundai commission, Annika Yee began with the question of what a natural history of machines could look and feel like, and we were elated to be her partners on this journey. I'm going to show you a little video from the Hyundai commission, official video for this commission.
Machines, they're either our slaves or our masters. And these Arabs, they don't necessarily have that kind of utility that we usually attribute to machines. Maybe that they're just here to be rewilded and that they're here to just coexist as a new kin species versus something that should perform and have some strict utility for us.
There we go.
So this installation was titled In Love with the World, and in this installation, we wanted to challenge visitors to the Tate Modern with a central question. What would it be like to live with a new emergent form of life, with a new form of intelligence that we hadn't encountered before. So we partner with Annika and her studio to design what these new life forms might look like, how they might act, and how they might interact with humans in this speculative future. We wanted to create machines that felt both familiar yet alien to visitors. They needed to be familiar enough that we could immediately project animalistic tendencies onto them and think of them more as alive than not. But they also needed to be alien enough that they were distinctly machine and didn't feel like we were just trying to recreate life. We wanted to find the balance between these two ends of the spectrum. We really wanted to stay clear of the uncanny valley while still straddling the ambiguous. So to achieve this, we built these machines called aerobes, and they're based off of the moon jelly, a pretty common life form that most people know of, yet also distinctly foreign and alien. So the one on the left is called the Xeno jelly, and that's based off of the Medusa form of jellyfish.
Actually, I think it's on the right.
What did I say? It's on the left.
On the right, yeah.
It's on the left. And the right one is the Planula, and that's based off of the Planula form of a jellyfish, which is actually a whole other form of jellyfish that they have. It's somewhere like a larva, except it doesn't come before the larva. Jellyfish are actually pretty complicated and alien in the way that they exist in the world. It's very nonlinear, unlike the way that we do. So these machines, they're helium-filled dirigibles that navigate space by flying, as you may have noticed in the video. In a technical sense, they're biomimetic dirigibles. They're designed to look organic, and they look biological, but they have a pretty remarkable amount of technology and craftsmanship put into their design. They're made of their handmade from lightweight materials, such as polyethylene plastic for the hull, carbon fiber rods for the tentacles, shaped foam and 3D printed parts for electronics mounting. And they fly around the hull through the use of those small propellers you see on the top right. Because they're helium-based machines, they basically weigh nothing. So they're extremely low power, extremely easy to move, and it means that we can have them interact with people because there's really no danger of having a beach ball fall on your head. One of the biggest challenges that we had was that we wanted to create behaviors for the aerobes that felt alive and felt intelligent, and were able to do all of that with nonverbal communication. They're kind of like animals in that they go about doing whatever they're going to do, but just by watching them, we wanted people to feel like there was an intentionality to them and that they knew what they were doing. They weren't just robot vacuums bumbling around, bumping into walls, and randomly exploring. So we created a pretty complex social intelligence that lived within these machines. We gave them a sense of perception, how they could perceive the world. We intentionally limited that in the software and the hardware so that they didn't have a high-res view of the world, so that they had kind of fuzzy and wrong notions sometimes of where things were, just like creatures have. We base their actual behaviors off of ethological studies of jellyfish. So we read a lot and a lot and a lot about jellyfish. We can talk after this talk all about jellyfish for days. But they have surprisingly complex behaviors. If we just see a jellyfish for 30 seconds, it looks like it's just floating around. But if you watch it for hours or days, they have intentionality, and they have motions that are repeated, and they have social structure, and they have ways that they interact with each other. We gave them both a physical environment that they could interact with, the turbine hall, but also a virtual environment, just like some animals do. They have senses that humans don't. Some of the things that they see are mysterious to us because it exists in a field of vision and perception that the human body just isn't designed for. And we created, as we saw, two distinct species. And these species interact with each other, both within the species, and they interact across species. So it was a pretty complex ecosystem that we had to create, and giving each one of these life forms its own motivations, its own goals, its own preferences, trying as much as we could to make them feel like they were their own distinct living things. So the xenojellies, these life forms with tentacles, they're interested in primarily in things that are different from them. As the name suggests, they're xenophiles. Since they're pretty much helium machines that are made from mechanical matter from plastic matter, our cold. Human biological matter is super interesting to them. They are very curious, very social, and definitely the more animalistic of the two. So they navigate the turbine hall looking for people, and they try to learn about people in their own way, by observing, by coming close, by standing at a distance, and they'll even gather and share what they've learned with each other. The planulae, on the other hand, are completely indifferent to humans. They're much more like plant or fungi. They're interested between the relationship between themselves and their environment and others of their species. They're constantly manipulating and terraforming an environment that is invisible to the human eye, but that they know about through their digital sensors. And almost like ants, they follow invisible trails that make it appear as if they're communicating to each other through their environment. They have group motions where they follow each other, they move in sequence, but again, just like ants, we can't see what they're communicating through or how they know where the others are moving and why. So with these goals and motivations in mind, each one of the 12 Arobes autonomously navigates the turbine hall throughout the day, juggling their internal motivations, each of their individual desires, with everything that's happening around them. And for 4 months, they literally went about their own business. We launched them, and there's no pilots, there's no choreography, there's no human intervention. They just exist the same way that birds might in a public park.
So now that we've described a little bit of how the installation actually works and how it's put together, let's watch a short video montage from the show itself.
The way that we imagine our relationships with machines is always either as subservient slaves, where the machines are serving us, we think of robots, of automation, of things that perform tasks for humans, or we think of them as threatening in some way, and we have a deep discomfort and fear of machines and machines becoming intelligent. What we were trying to approach was making a way that these machines could coexist with humans that didn't fit into either of those two kind of areas. The Arobes are fully autonomous in their behavior, meaning that the artificial life simulation makes all the decisions once the Arobes are up in the air. There's no pilot, there's no controller, there's no one telling them what to do and when.
We dug a lot into cognitive psychology here, and we looked at the research that underpins a lot of artificial life simulation, which is really based on psychology as we understand it, not just human psychology, but also animal behaviors and sort of modeling the motivations amongst animals and other biological creatures.
With an artificial life program, we start from motivations of the beings that we're creating. So we think about, what do these machines want? What do they feel? What would drive their behavior? And from that, we build from the bottom up a whole virtual mind for them.
And so, for example, if there's a crowd of visitors that are hanging out in one space, relaxing or lying down, which often happens, they'll find that really interesting, and they might come over and hover over you and do some very specific behaviors as they're, you know, sort of learning about you a little bit. And they may want to share that information with each other.
Annika wanted to work with someone that wasn't just technically capable, but she wanted to work with someone that could understand her creative vision and could really help bring the feeling of these machines being alive to the visitors at the turbine hall.
So a major reason that we were really excited to collaborate on this particular installation is that it gave us an opportunity to show the future, or a possible future, as if it was the present. Through a little bit of stagecraft, we could ask the audience to suspend their disbelief and just go on this journey with us to imagine what if it was real. And by allowing people to experience this installation, we can open up their minds for how we could coexist with machines in the future. And we really hope that this helped people think of machines more in similarly to how we think about animals as alternative life forms that could be companions or coworkers or even as feral and wild machines, but not really as a replacement for humans. And it turns out that if you give simple objects some intelligent movements, a little bit of motivation and intention, that can really trick our minds. For example, if you take a look at Roombas, even though they might not be that smart, if you watch them for a few minutes, you start to project agency behind its decisions, and creating enough space within this kind of an immersive experience for people to fill in the blanks with their own anthropomorphic assumptions can actually help bring machines to life. And by making machines look like plants or animals or other biological creatures, we help people kind of shift that expectation that they might have of machines. So in creating these installations that people can experience as a group and talk about and analyze, it means that they're not just likely to remember it, but to deeply synthesize this experience. People make meaning by exchanging ideas. This is inherently a social process and activity, and immersion into an environment is most effective when there's someone next to you so that they can also see what you see, hear what you hear, and validate the wonder and awe that you feel. The social experience is part of what assures us that this is real and it's not an illusion. Immersive experiences like this, they also have a way of activating our emotional mind. By immersing our senses in an experience, it tricks our brains into activating our emotional thinking instead of just using the rational mind. By inspiring feelings of fear, love, anxiety, or play, we can help to fast-track the experience to become a formative memory in someone's mind. So you might ask, what was the overall reaction from visitors to the Turbine Hall over the 4 months that this installation was up and running? We were able to be there for the first 2 weeks of the installation itself, and what we noticed was that people were forming these immediate feelings for the Arobes. They were having these experiences of friendship and ascribing personalities and strong traits to different Arobes. They were just generally really enjoying their company, and they weren't thinking of them as machines. In fact, the word machine was really charged. People didn't want to see them as machines. They saw them as creatures or as life forms that were inhabiting the space along with them. Kind of like when you go to an aquarium and you're watching whale sharks and stingrays moving around in that space, they kind of felt like they were at an aquarium and just watching these life forms navigating the space. So there was a real shift there about, you know, knowing these are handmade and man-made, but really not thinking about them machines any longer.
And while the visitors were the main focus of who we were trying to communicate with, we had some pretty unexpected results as well. The visitors only spent an hour or two at most with our machines, but there was plenty of staff at the Tate Modern that lived with them for 4 months every day, pretty much as coworkers. We spoke to the visitor assistants and the technical staff, and they had really bonded with the machines way more than we had imagined when we first set out making these. Everyone had their favorite Arobe. They projected individual personalities onto them. They knew which ones were friendly. They knew which ones were curious. They had ones that they thought of as shy. They felt that they had personalities that had even exceeded what we programmed. In a very technical sense, the things that they perceived probably weren't real at all, but in a very real and emotional sense, people felt real emotional connections to them. And when I said we didn't interact with them at all, I lied a little bit. It turns out that there aren't battery packs that are light enough to run them for 4 months, so they do have to come down on their own to ask for a battery change. And even that was a carefully considered part of the project. When they're ready for a battery change, they come back to the technician staff, which will give them a new battery, replace it, and send them up on their way. But even that action is one that's self-coordinated by the Arobe and its own mental model of the world. And these technicians that worked with the Arobes, they got to know the Arobes pretty deeply. They told me which ones were fickle, which ones were reliable, which ones were fussy and didn't really want to come back sometimes, and it was a pain to get them to come back for a battery change. Some of them caused a lot of stress and anxiety for the people that worked with them. And when I asked them more about the experience, they told me that it was like being a ranger in a wildlife preserve, that they felt like they were protecting these creatures. But they definitely felt like something that they weren't controlling. They didn't have agency or control over them. They just We're kind of there to keep oversight on them, make sure that everything stayed smooth and that the Arrow stayed safe.
So we wanted to give people a taste of what this future, speculated future could feel like. And now that we've shown you all of this, we'd like to just ask you for some thoughts or feedback that you had while you were watching some of the videos or learning about this, and if you had any questions for us.
So one thing you said about the aerophobes?
Aerobes, yeah.
Aerobes is they had desire. And I know, I mean, not every word is precise, but that itself is anthropocentric because these are ultimately inanimate objects.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to see them in our image, just like with God and so forth.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I have a little bit of a tangent, but what do you think about silicon-based consciousness?
So what do I think? I mean, that's such a broad question. You know, the funny story about the Turing test is we know the outcome of the Turing test. We know that the test is how do you decide if something is intelligent? But not a lot of people know the story. The story is that Alan Turing was wondering and trying to communicate with his collaborators, can machines think? And his conclusion was, this is way too complicated. We don't even know what that word means. What does it mean to think? So they came up with a shorthand that was, well, can we pass off as a human? That feels like a pretty reasonable, pretty reasonable yardstick for is something thinking and conscious. But it wasn't intentional. It was mostly out of a lack of other ways to think about consciousness. It just, human intelligence and consciousness feels intentional to us. I don't know about silicon consciousness. Like, I don't think consciousness is kind of a, there's this idea of a trash can word, right? It's like a trash bin. You throw lots of other ideas into there because you just don't know how to talk about those ideas. And I think consciousness in itself is too big of an idea to really pin down like that. But I think, you know, we've seen a lot about how silicon intelligence can exist and how there's different kinds of intelligence. Sorry if that doesn't quite answer your question.
Hi. I think this is a really cool and inspiring piece of art. And what I'm wondering, you said that they are learning and they are, like, observing the visitors. And could you tell a bit more what kind of AI or machine learning was behind them? And also how they experienced or what they took off from this after this 4 months, and what you did with that. Did you just switch it off, or is this somewhere what they experienced?
Mm-hmm.
Should I handle that?
You want
that?
Go for it.
Okay, go for it.
Okay. Well, so what we actually designed, and we went back and forth quite a bit on how their shared mind was going to work. They're basically using a simulated life system. A lot of what like environmentalists might use or scientists might use to recreate a lifelike system and study what happens over time. And they actually don't retain that information over the 4 months of time period. They're kind of living in the moment right then. But whatever they experience, each of them actually has slightly different traits that are tuned differently. So they would react to the same stimuli differently because each of them will actually have a set of traits that are slightly different. So some might actually be more curious about humans that are walking around the hall below it. Others might actually shy away from those same humans because their threshold for curiosity is that they really only like much larger groups and small groups freak them out or something along those lines. So they basically react in real time, but they don't kind of retain that information over time. Did you have anything else to add to that?
No, I think intentionally memory is another tricky topic. So in some ways it's one that we decided to intentionally sidestep in favor of just kind of focusing more on their being in the moment and how they're interacting and responding to stimuli. They're, you know, like jellyfish, a lot more like reflexive intelligence than they are like a planning intelligence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi guys. This first question is just a follow-up to someone else's question, but
if you had to approach the question like about consciousness, how do you think of consciousness, and what is your definition of that?
It's very philosophical. It's a very big question. I think in this particular project, if I just constrain myself to that, we were really focused on trying to identify motivation, and it was actually really tricky. I would say we spent almost a year just going back and forth within our studio and with the artist studio and with the museum, just thinking about, well, do we need these machines to have motivation so that there's a reason that they want to do something, right? Like, how do you just propel activity and behaviors? It can't arise out of nothing. You have to have a goal of some sort, a desire that leads you forward throughout the day and through life. Otherwise, you just have randomness, right? Like the early model Roombas that just bump around forever. And so what we decided was that we'd really try to think about them like sea creatures or oceanic creatures that are existing, where we can't interpret their lived experience and understand how they experience consciousness, but we can say one species is really motivated by xenophilia and is motivated by finding body heat and wants to go and explore that. That's what they're curious about, because that's something we can observe from the outside that they tend to do. But we don't know what that consciousness would be like for them, for their experience internally.
Yeah, I'd just like to add that I think in different circles that think about artificial intelligence, there's this distinction between apparent intelligence and what's considered a more human intelligence. And apparent intelligence is, did it solve a problem quickly and efficiently? And that's a lot like what modern artificial intelligence does. We don't know how neural networks solve problems. We know that they're incredibly complex and they're incredibly efficient and they can compute answers, but they don't think about the problem and consider the problem in a way that humans do and the human mind does.
Or that we can even observe.
Yeah, and human intelligence is, you know, much more process-based, where we want computers or we want other systems to evaluate the problem in a way that looks familiar to us. And it's really hard to know the difference, because to know the difference between them, you have to actually be able to peer into the process of decision-making. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, consciousness is that same way, where intelligence we can identify externally and look at something and usually decide if we think it's intelligent, but consciousness is an internal phenomenon of only you know if you're conscious, other entities can't know if you're conscious.
Right. Yeah, thank you. Your response triggered another question, if you guys will allow it. But so do you think deep learning, maybe reinforcement learning, are all we need to eventually achieve AGI or human-like intelligence, if, you know, whatever you want to call it? Or do we need another component that, you know, we don't have yet?
Personally, I think that the fact that no appreciable progress has been made on general intelligence in over 70 years kind of speaks for itself on if the tech we're going in the right direction. I don't portray myself as an expert in the field to know what needs to be done, but it definitely seems like the things that we're trying are really great at specialized intelligence, but aren't making much progress towards general intelligence.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. Sorry if you already addressed this because I came in late, but I mean, I'm interested in the critique of artificial intelligence from a more bodily, embodied kind of perspective. So I guess my question would be whether, I mean, the actual form of these creatures, machines, whatever we want to call them, did have some kind of impact on the way they, I mean, developed intentionality, consciousness, intelligence, whatever you want to call it. I mean, and that goes to the whole discussion about consciousness as well. I mean, some would say we actually need a body to have some kind of idea of, you know, something that limits us and that makes us a subject to develop consciousness and then also intelligence. So the actual form of these arrows, did that play a role in its intelligent development, so to speak?
Yes, it absolutely did. Yeah, I would say that the form of the Arabs, the fact that they are airborne, that they don't interact with creatures that exist on the plane that you and I do, on the floor, on the ground floor, completely changed. And I guess in a lot of ways, it really affected our way of thinking about their perception of the world and how they might interact with others and how they might behave. Because the navigation within the air, them being really light, it kind of affects everything about their experience. And so that did drive a lot of how we developed the mental model for them. Do you want to speak to that some more?
No, I think that pretty much adequately gets it. Just the physicality is so important. At the end of the day, the artificial intelligence that drives them is a software program on a computer, but that doesn't feel alive to us at all. Right. If you just watch bits flip on a computer. But the moment that the software is controlling a thing that has a physical presence and a physical form, the exact same intelligence suddenly, just the way that we interact with it and the way we perceive it is completely different. So I agree that it's an absolutely crucial part of the experience.
Right. Yeah, we really had to think about, you know, what does it look like if we want to show curiosity through a body that navigates space so differently, or if we want to show sociability or anxiety or fear, if we want these kinds of, you know, almost like allow people to be able to see and reflect different emotions and mirror those onto these creatures, we had to really think about how they're going to navigate that space and how to express that through not having a face, not having a directional, like, forward. They don't have, they're kind of, you know, circular and blobs. So yeah, it was definitely a big part of it. Good question.
So you mentioned at one point that, like, at a certain point, a human collaborating with a machine could consistently defeat, like, just a machine in chess. But now that's no longer the case. And, you know, like, pure machines can outperform a human-machine combination. And also, so in these creatures that you design, you say that, like, they have their internal experiences that are invisible to humans. They have their internal systems of experience that humans can't really understand, and yet the viewers of the exhibition would try to anthropomorphize them to some degree anyway. Exactly. So my question is, like, in a world then where perhaps it's filled with these machines that aren't really relatable, that we can't really empathize with, but perhaps that we'll still try to, and also are competing, interacting with the same resources as we are, and perhaps better than we can, isn't that still quite dystopian? And how do you reconcile with that?
Well, we didn't portray them as competing for the same resources because they have different motivations and different goals in their day-to-day, like, life. They're kind of existing alongside us. So, for example, we were talking a bit about the aerobe that has the tentacles, the xenojelly, being attracted to just, like, heat signatures. The other aerobes, the ones that just look like blobs, those are actually picking up pheromone trails, or that are entirely digital, that are left behind every time the xenojellies are excited and gathering information about heat blobs. And so they're actually interacting with these digital trails that are left behind, and they go over and they kind of groom the space and clear the air back up, and they do some regrowth situation that's entirely only visible to them. So from the visitor's perspective, they have no idea what these things are doing above them. They're interacting in an entire ecosystem, and we're just one part of that.
Right, and, like, but by virtue of having physical bodies and existing in the same world, if you look at it on a grander scale, like, of course, they need resources to survive, and perhaps especially if they're self-replicating, they're inevitably like life in so many ways that perhaps they can't be distinguished by life. And so to me, like, this, you mentioned how they have their own, like, trails of digital pheromones, et cetera. I mean, that's pretty much like internal experience. It's like an internal experience that we can't empathize with.
Yep.
And absolutely. So if we still see them using the resources that we use and interacting in the same space, and we try to understand them, and yet we can't, isn't that scarier than if we could understand them?
Maybe. But, you know, that's life.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, the way that I respond immediately to that is just, like, do you feel threatened by birds in the trees outside that are searching, you know, utilizing the same resources as us on a planet that has a limited number of resources? Or do you feel threatened by fish in the ocean? Or do you feel threatened by
mushrooms,
feral cats? Like, we already live in a system with scarce, limited resources on our planet and plenty of life forms that are implicitly competing for them. But we don't have these emotional feelings that, you know, birds are somehow a life form that must be exterminated because they're competing with us. And I think that's along the lines of the feelings that we were trying to recreate, was, you know, more of this kind of moment of serendipity and being in the moment and just feeling that these things that felt otherworldly, and, you know, if you see a robot normally, you'll stop and look. And we almost wanted people to just feel like they were birds that lived inside.
Thank you.
So my question sort of segues out of that. But given our history of the utilitarian relationship we have with machines, was the universal response awe, or was anyone kind of freaked out by the creatures watching them? Did you have to make it clear that there weren't cameras in them? I mean, this is in the UK where there are cameras everywhere, and there's China. And I was going to a sort of dystopic future where these very friendly looking creatures are really recording all of our activities in some, you know, 2040 future state. And, you know, they look friendly, but they're actually, they've got a utility to someone, L. Bob Reif, or someone out there who's in control. So I just wonder if anybody, I could see you responding with awe, and I could also see thinking, do these things have cameras in them? You know, are they recording me? I would have both of those thoughts at the same time, and I just wonder if, obviously you made them beautiful and biological, but then someone else might do that for a different purpose. So I just wondered if you had any of those
types of reaction.
Yeah.
I'll start. That's a really good question. Actually, when we were working on this project, the pandemic hit, so everything was pushed out by a year. The Tate Modern was on and off, closed and open and so on. And so we had 2 years to worry about this exact thing and wonder about it and wonder how much do we want to actually exaggerate fears? Do we want people to wonder? Do we want it to be a very divisive experience? Versus how much do we want to kind of hew away from that? And the museum itself was also really concerned about, you know, well, if they're gathering information on the visitors, what does that feel like? Will people be concerned that their data is being stolen? Will people wonder if there are cameras embedded in them? And so this is definitely a topic that we talked about in circles over and over and over for a long time. And we decided we were going to be okay with the ambiguity and also not really explain exactly what was happening and see what happens with the crowd of the visitors when they come. And just we had a lot of trained, well-trained VAs that were in the space to answer questions. But we figured we would kind of run it like an experiment and just see what happens. And I gotta say, I was really shocked that pretty much across the board, people just wanted to lie down and match their breathing to the movement of the machines, and it was very, very zen. Like, it was just this super trance-like kind of energy most of the time. Yeah, so it was pretty wild, because that was definitely a concern that we had, and what we found was that people were just very comfortable and warm. But there were a lot of questions. There was lots and lots and lots of conversation that people had about whether or not, like, how they were working, how alive they were, how they could sense whether they were there or not.
How autonomous they were. Was there, you know, someone in a back room with a joystick, like, flying each of them and watching everyone in the hall?
There were people looking for strings to see if they were being moved around. But yeah, it was really interesting that we spent 2 years worrying and wondering over that problem, and in our experience, it didn't really turn out that way at all, especially in the UK where there are so many cameras.
This is not going to be a smart question because I'm still grappling with this, but it seems to me that the one distinction is that animals are part of an ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So they have bacteria on them, they eat things. What happens if these become part of an ecosystem? Do you then have a responsibility to keep that ecosystem intact? Like, if these things start to grow bacteria on them, does that then become a protectable ecosystem that you would then disrupt by taking them out of circulation? It's a sort of an unformed thought.
No, that's really good.
I think these are actually exactly the kinds of questions that we want to provoke people to think about, right? To start thinking about machines in ways that they hadn't before. But I think to respond to it directly, in some sense, machines already are a part of our ecosystem. Like, they already exist. Plastic and metal parts are already going into landfills and being a part of trash. There's already life forms that are adapting to, you know, fungi that are learning to break down metals and break down plastics because of this new form of material and energy that's available in our ecosystem. So I think it's really interesting to provoke people to have that exact thought and to, you know, lead them to realize that we've already introduced these things into the ecosystem that we live in.
Hi, my name is Emil Chavez. So, I mean, thinking back on y'all's talk, y'all talked a lot about Deep Blue and stuff like that. And it's interesting to kind of think back on that, how people tend to underestimate machines. And I believe people still do a lot of times, even though we have this fear of them. Because I remember back in the day, there was kind of like a theory going around that Deep Blue was actually like had like a human helping it. And that was like controversial. But nowadays we kind of just assume, oh, no, that computer obviously was smart enough to outthink us. And I, for one, never thought that, because I'm an artist, I would never have thought that like AI or machines would ever be able to get into like the arts and things, because I always thought they didn't have the creative input to do that. So sort of, I sort of wondered, even though you say that it's good to have machines be able to work alongside us, do you still believe that it's still possible for them to still go a step above and say, well, they are still more efficient than we are at these things, so why do they still need us humans to help them if they can do everything?
If you put me in a tank, probably like a water aquarium tank, I probably wouldn't be able to sneak out of some random tubes, but octopuses can. And then they can go out and explore stuff and come back into the tank and pretend like they never left. So they've definitely surpassed us in being able to get through.
In that definition.
In
of
that
it,
particular
or that
definition.
Sense.
Yeah, octopuses are super smart. Love them.
Yeah. So I think that's kind of what we wanted to explore, is that just because something is smarter than us in some ways doesn't mean that we don't need to hang around and exist anymore. All kinds of intelligences exist around us that are much more efficient or much better at doing certain things, certain tasks, and certain behaviors that they've developed for just being able to exist in life. And that doesn't mean that we don't exist. Like, there are still creatures that, you know, can walk partly, like amphibious creatures that can walk along the bottom of the ocean floor and then into air and breathe a little bit and then come back into the water. We still manage to learn how to walk entirely in the air and then learn how to fly, or birds learned how to fly. So, like, evolution doesn't really kind of stop at a certain point and go, aha, we've achieved peak life form. It's actually all divergent and it's all happening at the same time. And I guess what we were positing is that machines are just one of those examples that could coexist at the same time without it being the one.
Right. Yeah, I definitely say that computers are really excellent at tasks, but they're not really good at jobs, if that distinction makes sense. Like, there's very narrow things that computers can do exceptionally well, but they're not, I think, as I answered another question earlier, just the general intelligence isn't there. And humans are definitely, we're the best at multitasking and handling unexpected situations. But like, computers still just, you know, they can't compete with that. And I think that's one of the best reasons that computers make really good complements for human intelligence.
Right. One last question though, because I mean, eventually, computers could potentially, of course, learn to adapt like humans can with those thoughts. And I will love the day when octopuses can come out of the ocean and commune with us. I'll love that day. But do you think that we should potentially stunt AI growth potentially, and, like, you know, just like avoid it from maybe becoming too strong? Or do you think we should just embrace AI and just let it be free and to grow smart?
I mean, I think we definitely get into some ethics issues there of just thinking about how we develop different kinds of intelligences, and what we aspire for, what we have set out as goals and aspirations for them. And I think that's probably a whole panel that might exist.
Yeah, I think that at the end of the day, the machines don't make decisions about how they're used. Humans are making decisions about how they're being used. And I think there's, personally, I think that we should continue to think of them as tools, but we should be really thoughtful and intentional about what it means for something to be tools. And just because something is a tool doesn't mean you can think of it, you have to think of it as being like a hammer, right? Like I said, like we've alluded to so many times, like we think of animals as tools in so many different ways. And that doesn't take away from their intelligence, but their intelligence is just a different kind of tool that we use for very narrow and specific problem solving.
All right, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry. You said several things in response to people's questions that I just wanted to kind of clear up. So this experiment existed outside of natural selection, right? So the era that we exist in, this Earth is groomed. Now, there are things at the bottom of the ocean and, you know, things we haven't been able to fuck up yet. But at the end of the day, the species that exist because we allow it. We didn't, anything that was competitive, we killed. Any bird that was a threat is dead. So the birds that don't threaten us now are not the same as the birds that used to threaten us back then. So then introducing a biological thing is introducing a life form that is something that we want in the environment. And if it serves no purpose other than to entertain or be looked at, it's not competing for resources. I don't think that it changes that hierarchy of man dominating the world, man, woman, child, whatever. I don't see how it becomes dominant as in this diagram either, because as soon as it begins to compete for resources, it'll be naturally selected by man out of there.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're describing is a very hierarchical and Western view of the natural world and how we're all competing for the same things. And that's not the only way to exist.
I wholeheartedly agree. And in the dawn of man, I think that circular diagram definitely was more appropriate. But in the sculpted and groomed world that we've created, the natural resources that we exploited thus far, I'm not making a value proposition that I want that. There's just evidence of that, right? A tiger's not going to saunter out and become the mayor of New York, right?
No, but it's interesting that we still see examples that I think kind of contradict that what you're saying. Like, I think it was in the last, it was about 60 years ago, constructing the Trans-Afghan Railroad in Australia. The whole railroad being built in relatively the modern age was held up by emus. Emus didn't like the people there and would come, and they were aggressive, they would raid tents, and it was described by people on the railroad as guerrilla warfare by animals, because the animals know the terrain better, they're fast, they're vicious, and they're like, man, if these birds don't want us here, like, this sucks.
So what was the human solution to that problem?
They spent about 5 years trying to exterminate the emus, and they couldn't. So they gave up, and they built the railroad through a different part of the desert in Australia. Yeah. It's pretty wild that animals, you know, there's still cases where it's like, we think of ourselves as like, oh yes, humanity, we can dominate the world however we want, and even that assumption is still being proven wrong.
Yeah, I would say that we haven't necessarily consciously shaped all of the natural world, and I think a lot of it happens accidentally. And the natural world adapts and does other things too that we may or may not be aware of.
Sure.
So there's a certain amount of like intentionality to how this world's being shaped that you're ascribing that I don't think has been consistently put into practice by humanity through millennia.
Well, I mean, most of our progress is within the last 100 years, right? Technologically. Like, it's been a very exponential growth in the last century.
It's been, yeah, most of our digital technology has arisen in the past 100 years.
Well, all of our digital technology.
Yeah.
But, and so that reminds me of just, if I'm not boring everyone to death, just a comment on the computing. You said several times, oh, computers are just this, or computers are good at tasks, or computers whatever. That, in my opinion, is just a limitation of the computing power, right? So the things that we're seeing in AI and machine learning were not possible before the rise of GPUs, affordable memory, et cetera. So if you look at quantum computing, that promises to deliver levels of computing that are unheard of. And given that there's already been works, you know, like Wolfram's book, A New Science, where he his whole thesis boils down to the entire universe is digital with a little token that kind of goes around and one
yeah,
operation
I
occurs at
I think that worldview
time.
Is still, you know, the jury's still out on that, whether new conforms of computation are just letting us do the same old thing faster, mm-hmm. or whether we're doing it fundamentally differently. And it's still definitely an open question in my mind of whether all we need is faster computers and more compute. Yeah, whether the question is more power or whether the solution is a different approach. And I definitely am in the camp of a new approach is needed. And just the fact that we can do more parallel computations isn't going to solve that specific problem.
Cool. Right,
cool.
Thank you.
So thanks so much, everyone. Yeah, I think we've hit time. Thank you so much for sticking around.
Thank you.
Thank you.